I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, a pioneer in the satellite and pharmaceutical industries. She's the founder of Sirius Satellite Radio and United Therapeutics, a public pharmaceutical company initially focused on treating cardiopulmonary disorders. Martine also helped to launch the car navigation system Geostar and the satellite service provider PanAmSat, which was sold to a division of General Motors in 1995 for $3 billion. Martine lives in Vermont. She's a helicopter pilot and a parent of four children. She also used to be a man named Martin. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You are trans a lot of things. I'd like to start with your trans corporate life.
Okay.
You are a pioneer in the satellite industry, and it all started in the Seychelles, strangely, in a group of islands off of Africa. Can you describe the linkage between your discovery in the Seychelles and your career?
Sure. I really had no idea of what I wanted to do in life when I was in the Seychelles. In fact, I'd read a Newsweek article that this was supposed to be an idyllic set of islands where you could just catch fish literally with your hands and drink coconut milk. So I dropped out of UCLA and went traveling over there, feeling just really oppressed by the LA environment. So I get to the Seychelles, but it was really pretty dirty. I rented a small hut. Every night the floor would fill with gigantic cockroaches, but I was there, so I just, you know, hung out and did the best I could. One day, one of the Seychelles friends I met asked me if I wanted to go with him up to the NASA tracking station. I didn't even know there was a NASA tracking station. I went up with him, and there it was like I stepped into another reality. I went from like the past to the future. Everything was super clean and shiny and high-tech looking with blinking lights. And a very nice NASA engineer gave us a tour and explained what they were doing. And I asked him, why is this antenna that you have so humongous? Because it was bigger than a house. And he said, it's because the signals that we're tracking from deep space probes are so faint, they don't even have enough energy to light a light bulb. So we have to have a humongous collecting area in our giant satellite dish to receive the signal. And I asked him back, well, what if the satellite signals were very, very strong and powerful? He said, well, it's not possible to launch those type of satellites today, but if it was, then our receiving station could be very small and tiny. And the idea dawned in my head that if I could figure out a way to launch a powerful satellite, then everybody in the world could have their own tiny satellite receiving dish. Mm-hmm. I made a beeline back to UCLA. It's like I received a kind of quasi-religious epiphany in the Seychelles that I was going to connect the world with satellite communications, and this was a technologically practical thing to do. So I went from having a C average at UCLA to straight A's because I had a passion that I was going to be the world's expert on satellite communications.
You were in your late 20s.
Correct.
Were there other examples in your life of, you know, having the moxie to say, you know what, I'm going to transform something? What were examples of that in your childhood?
My transformative examples were from biographies and also from science fiction. I was fascinated with the Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov series of books. And those examples of people who transcended their background to become, you know, the man who purchased the moon and people who went to Mars, those books inspired me.
Your mother always thought there was something unique about you, but I just thought, well, you know, welcome to being a Jewish mother. Did you ever have a sense of self that kind of extended beyond what you thought other peers experienced?
No, I didn't. I really felt myself pretty much a totally average person and lazy and usually trying to figure out the way to get something done with the least amount of work.
And how about your parents?
My parents were hardworking and great people, but my dad was a dentist for the Retail Clerks Union, so he had kind of like a 9-to-6 job. My mother was a speech pathologist at San Diego State College, so she would go there and teach each day.
What, in your mind, was the most pioneering or innovative experience you had in the satellite realm?
One of the, to me, the most remarkable stories is when I was running Sirius, one of the business plans was to get the major radio stations to major radio networks to invest in Sirius and to put their content on our satellite network. So I went to see Mel Karmazin, who was at that time the CEO of Infinity Radio Network, which hosted the Howard Stern Show nationwide. And I went to Mel and I did my satellite radio pitch and I said, this is going to be the future. Everyone is going to listen to satellite radio. And he laughed at me and he turned, pivoted on his desk to his credenza and he said, you see these piles of paper here? He said, these are audience research reports that I commissioned to find out what the audience listening to each of our radio station thinks, what their demographics are, what their age is, how many of them are. He said, now, how high are those piles going to be the day you launch your Sirius XM radio system? I said, well, on the first day, there'll be nobody listening to it. He said, exactly. He said, Martine, get a real job. So the funny coded...
Fast forward a few years later, and who becomes the CEO of Sirius?
Mel Karmazin, yeah. And I loved having a chance to recount the story to him when I was on the Howard Stern Show. He remembered it. But it just goes to show... What he was saying was not incorrect, but my vision for Sirius was pay radio. And his whole paradigm of regular radio was commercial advertiser-supported radio. So it's an entire paradigm shift that had to be promoted.
What else surprised you about launching a service like Sirius? Was it the regulatory hurdles or?
I expected there to be regulatory hurdles. That process always involves taking the radio frequencies away from somebody else. So there's always an adversarial process involved. But what has surprised me with Sirius, to this day, I would say more people come up to me and thank me for providing Howard Stern and other content to them via Sirius, then people come up to me and thank me for saving their children with the medicines that we produce at United Therapeutics.
What does that say?
I think it says that information is very, very important. In fact, there's a quotation I've heard that says, information is the necessary, if not sufficient, basis for development.
You left Sirius and you found yourself in another industry, the pharmaceutical industry. And I purposely used the passive because it didn't seem like an active decision to go into the pharmaceutical industry just on the face of it. You have a daughter, Genesis, whom you discovered has a disease, a pulmonary hypertension disease. And she's the one who came up with the idea that you launched this company. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's true that my first love and actually most lasting love is space technology, satellite communications. If I could snap my fingers and sort of like, you know, reimagine the whole universe, I would be right back running either Sirius XM or probably even like a Elon Musk SpaceX type of company. But the fact of the matter is that I love my children, and my youngest daughter, who is just a beautiful, simple child, gets diagnosed with this life-threatening disease, pulmonary hypertension. There were no medicines available, so it wasn't a matter of thinking about it. I just went to the library and began doing research.
Now, you mentioned you went to the library, but it was you and she who would go to the library
we
together.
Would. That's true.
7-year-old Genesis.
Yes, we would together. She was very, very helpful, and I would say to her, I know there was an article by Dr. Rich, and she would say, wait a second, and this is Stuart Rich, a physician in Illinois, and she'd look through the pile of Xerox copies of articles and say, here's the Dr. Rich article.
You launched United Therapeutics with your own capital.
That's correct.
From Sirius. The drug, which later got FDA approval, was developed by a gentleman, James Crow.
Correct. There was a gentleman, Dr. Crow, at GlaxoSmithKline, who had a solution for pulmonary hypertension, a new medicine, but Glaxo would not let him develop it because the patient population was too small. And GlaxoSmithKline had recently purchased the Burroughs Wellcome Company. Burroughs Wellcome was a very old line pharmaceutical company, and they would develop things whether they were profitable or not. So SmithKline, Glaxo, bought them. And when they bought them, the first thing they said is, we are not pursuing any more of these, fairy tale dreams. We have a filter. We will only pursue drugs that promise $1 billion or more in revenues, which are called blockbusters.
You got hold of Dr. Crow's telephone number?
Yes.
And called him?
Yes, cold called him.
And what was his posture towards you originally?
Great skepticism. How is somebody who is a satellite CEO going to develop a medicine? How are you going to get it out of a pharmaceutical company? I'm very sorry about your daughter, but there's nothing I can do to help you.
Miss Martine Rothblatt, upon hearing that, that probably just put more fire under your belly.
It did. I was actually, he did me a great favor by doing that because I was pretty much back to the Martine who was galvanized by the dream of uniting the world with satellite communications. And I said, now, you know what? I did something like that. I can do this. Yeah. I can do this. And coincidentally, at the very same time frame, people sent me two movies to watch. One was Lorenzo's Oil. There was a story of a father trying to save his son by doing things that pharmaceutical companies wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And another was the, to me, the archetypical entrepreneur movie called Tucker, about this man who invented the seatbelt, the parabolic headlight lens for cars, the shatterproof glass for windows, who after World War II tried to create a new type of automobile called the Tucker and was beaten down by the big three automakers in Michigan.
United Therapeutics is public. You became the highest paid female CEO in America. Upon FDA approval, the stock price went up exponentially. And how do you navigate that? What does that mean exactly?
So what it really means is that my compensation is tied to our stock price.
So this was as of 2013. And you're not somebody who really revels in the public light. What were your reactions when media was coming to you because of this fact that happened almost accidentally?
So it's basically a kind of embarrassment, at least in my own personality. I don't try to be the center of attention. But I do realize as a public company CEO, every element of my compensation is publicly disclosed.
And by the way, when I first read that fact and the fact that you were previously a man, I thought, seriously, the highest paid female CEO, of course, has to have had been a man.
I feel that that's unfair, too. I agree with you. I tell you the truth, I had exactly the same feeling. But I do know in other years, the highest paid female CEO had always been a female. So I'm sort of like the exception that proves the rule.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt. We'll hear more from Martine coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, a pioneer in the satellite and pharmaceutical industries. She's the founder of Sirius Satellite Radio and United Therapeutics, a public pharmaceutical company initially focused on treating cardiopulmonary disorders. Martine lives in Vermont. She's a helicopter pilot and a parent of four children. She also used to be a man named Martin. United Therapeutics is public, and your annual reports, I think they're kind of
different.
Unconventional. You tell me about them.
So our annual reports are different. One of our annual reports was in the form of a graphic novel that told the story of a new employee. Another of the annual reports was in the form of a children's book. It was patterned after Goodnight Moon. It was called Good Year UTHR, that being our ticker symbol. Another of the annual reports is in the form of what we call a periodic tablecloth of utelements. So we make an annual report because that's something that's legally required, but there's no rule that says your annual report can't be a children's book.
The company now is extending beyond just hypertension, and I'm intrigued by your focus on xenotransplantation, which is basically taking animal organs and surgically putting them into human beings.
Correct. Although the real trick there is to first genetically modify the animal organ so that it will not be rejected when it's put into the human being. And we formed a joint partnership with Craig Venter's company, the man who decoded the human genome, called Synthetic Genomics is the name of his company.
Why focus on a pig versus another animal?
So it's an odd quirk of nature that of all the animals in the animal kingdom, the animal whose organs match the size and shape of humans better than any others is the pig, even better than chimpanzees, by the way.
Now, this is somebody who grew up in an observant Jewish household. Were there any even irrational just reactions that you might have had when you first discovered this?
You know, the good thing about all religions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, is they really are very rational within their own belief system. So Judaism, like Islam, like Christianity and Hindu, believe that the sanctity of life rises above all other things. By the way, I did my PhD thesis on xenotransplantation. I interviewed rabbis, imams, people from all the different religions, and it turned out that all of them said, we accept the transplantation of animal organs, pig organs in particular, into bodies. So it's kosher. It's halal. It's okay if it's being done to save a human's life.
You have a pig farm in Vermont. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Right. So the name of the pig farm, it's called Revivicor. What's grown there are pigs that already have several genes knocked out. We now be having modified the first few genes of the pig. Our organs, when they're placed into a person, last from months to as long as over a year now at the NIH. In fact, my mantra to the company is inspired by JFK's mantra when he said, I want to land a man on the moon and safely return them to the Earth before the end of the decade. I tell people in our company that we want to transplant a xenolung into a patient and return that patient safely to health before the end of this decade.
You're a helicopter pilot. Is there any connection between wanting to get your helicopter license and this endeavor?
As most people know, when organs are donated for transplantation, they're generally transported by helicopter because you only want to have the organ outside of a bodily system, outside of blood and whatnot, for a short period of hours. So to avoid traffic jams and to go over long distances, organs are usually transported by helicopter or plane from location to location. I'm also a fixed-wing pilot as well. It would give me a great sense of completion of accomplishment to be able to personally deliver one of our first sets of xenolungs to a waiting patient.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, the founder of the pharmaceutical company United Therapeutics. Martine is transgender. She became a woman in 1994 at age 40 after having had sex reassignment surgery. I want to talk about your transgender life. How has this physical change changed the way you feel?
That's a really tough question to answer, especially, you know, briefly. I think the answer that really bubbles to my mind is, as being core and essential, is that I've always felt like a woman. So I found myself, as I went into my teenage years, identifying with the women in the room where I would be instead of the men in the room. Yet I was totally, obviously aware that everybody considered me a boy and then a man. And I was totally aware that when somebody deviated from those socially accepted roles, that they were sanctioned, they were laughed at. I didn't want to be laughed at. So I kept my feelings of being a woman tightly bottled up inside myself because I didn't really want to be laughed at.
I would think a man who understands women would be very attractive to women. Did you have girlfriends? And
I did. I mean, when you're talking about like sexual orientation side of being a woman, my sexual orientation has always been to women as a woman. So if I was to give it a label, it would be a lesbian label. Yet I was faced with this contradiction that I had the body of a man.
What's an example of, you know, you're identifying with the women in the room?
I'd say, like, if there is a topic being faced in the room and one group of people are kind of hard-edged about solving the problem and the other group of people are maybe like, maybe there's a way we can massage the situation, I just naturally go to the massage the situation.
In 1995, you wrote a manifesto called The Apartheid of Sex, which demystified or criticized the classification of things by gender.
That's correct. And My point of view was that was really based on the research that came before me, specifically Professor Anne Fausto-Sterling from Brown, who had written that there are not two sexes. There are actually multiple different sexes. She discovered, for example, that it's not as simple as saying women have two X chromosomes and men have an X and a Y, because there are people born with two X's and one Y, two Y's and one X, all kind of variants in between. But in most cases, these intersexualities were not so manifest that they were observed by surgeons at the time of birth. So nobody said, oh, this is an intersex child.
So these are genetic mutations.
Yeah. I would say it's part of the natural diversity of human life. And so that got me thinking, well, if there's all of this fluidity in the body, there must be just as much fluidity in the mind.
You said that separating people by gender is similar to separating blacks and whites, which, of course.
And by the way, when I wrote that, it was considered like crazy. Mm-hmm. But now in Germany and a couple of other municipalities, parents can decide not to stamp male or female on a child's birth certificate. Mm-hmm. And the idea of being gender queer, basically self-defining one's own gender, has gone from being, you know, totally on the margins to, I would say, for people who are like millennial generation, it's beginning to be like, you know, a thread of that culture.
Speaking of race, your wife is African-American, Bina Aspin. You married her in 1981 when you were a man, and it was a surprise to her 10 years later that you wanted to undergo this sexual reorientation. Mm-hmm. How long were you thinking about this before you actually mentioned it to her?
Well, I would think about it the whole time because I've been transgendered feeling since I was a teenager. So I thought about it the whole time, but it was something that I thought just had to be bottled up forever. And fortunately, there were pioneers who came before me in the 1970s and 1980s, people like the ophthalmologist Renee Richards, who also became a tennis star. And I read other biographies of transgendered people who had come out. And there's a judge in Houston, Texas, Judge Phyllis Fry. So these people gave me hope and inspiration that maybe I could come out as well.
And her response?
Her response was immediately open. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, my God. There was never an oh, my God. It was, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really interesting. That's fine with me. I love you for your soul, not any part of your skin.
And she calls you Martine. She's Martine sexual.
And I feel my identity is being a sexual.
Your children, talk to me about your approach to them. And I'm curious as to the array of responses.
Sure. Well, all four of them were very accepting. And I'm eternally grateful to them for that, because so many other transgendered people I know have horrible situations of being disowned by portions of their family. And so I said to each of the four kids that this is what I wanted to do, change my sex to female, but I would not do it if they objected. And each of them had a very different response, perhaps reflecting their various ages. The oldest was my son, Eli. He was about 20, okay? And he said, it's your life, Martine. You have to do what you want to do with your life. He was a student at Johns Hopkins at the time. The next oldest was Sunny. She's a fashion designer here in New York City now. She was at that time about 18. And she said, lots of my friends have two moms or two dads. I don't see anything so strange about that. So it's really interesting that she saw it in a totally different way, as just like now she has two moms.
That's right.
Whereas I've actually never really tried to be the mom. They still call me dad, but that's how she saw it. My son, Gabriel, who was in junior high at the time.
Hardest, probably.
Yep, it was the hardest. And he said that friends would tease him. And he said he only wanted to know would I still be his dad. And I promised him, Gabriel, I'll always be your dad, no matter what. And he said, okay, it's okay with me.
I read in New York Magazine that you said, well, I'm going to be like a butterfly.
Yes, I did say that. He has four children now, and they call me Grand Martine. And then the youngest, Genesis, she was quite young. She was 10 years old. And she was actually the one who outed me to my own parents. because she told them, you know, Martine has these women's clothes that she and mom wear when they go out places. And then my dad and mom asked me, is this true? Why would you do this? But Genesis said, well, it seems to me just I love my dad and she loves me. Hmm. And it was just remarkable how she just switched the pronoun and made the whole thing make sense.
That's right.
So she said, okay.
And your mother?
My mom said, look, we could have had two daughters or a son and a daughter. It doesn't make any difference to us.
I've noticed sometimes in this interview I'm confusing pronouns and things like that. Does that get under your skin?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. I'm like totally flexible with it. In fact, it's kind of an interesting recherche test to me. Just going out with strangers, some people say ma'am, some people say sir. It's almost like 50-50. And it's kind of really interesting. But I'm like, as long as, you know, you call me Martine, I'm happy.
See, you have the mind of a woman. Like, you're so understanding.
Thank you.
Was marrying an African-American woman almost equally striking to people at the time?
It was shocking to some people. Mm-hmm. This was less than 20 years after it was illegal for people to marry people of different races. The Supreme Court case Loving versus Virginia was decided in the 1960s. So it was, our kids were teased. Our oldest son, Eli, said kids at school would call him a zebra. So I think it was analogous.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, the highest paid transgendered CEO in America. Martine is also transhuman, launching efforts to extend human life and achieve immortality through biotech and artificial intelligence. Her most recent book, called Virtually Human, The Promise and Peril of Digital Immortality, is written with Ray Kurzweil, the lead engineer at Google. Could you describe briefly the thesis of your book?
Sure. A lot of the top engineers in Silicon Valley have been working on creating cyber consciousness, allowing things like Siri to develop greater and greater capabilities until they're really personality operating systems. So what always intrigued me about that, perhaps because of my legal background and I have the PhD in medical ethics, what are the ethical consequences of creating consciousness in software? Do we have the right to create consciousness and consciousness and then just turn it off?
Now, your hope is to, if I'm speaking correctly, you know, being transhuman is to bring immortality and life extension to people both in the body, but also out of body through things like mind clones.
Well, that's right. I believe that the purpose of the biotechnology industry in general is to keep people alive longer. So Ray Kurzweil was, I think, the first person to ask, well, when does that end? You know, if you ask yourself that question, you realize that there is no ending point, that as long as somebody values their life, we all would like to keep that person alive as long as possible.
So what will happen to your body when it dies?
When my body dies, it will like, you know, well, in the case of me in particular, mm-hmm. it will be frozen at a company called Alcor in Arizona, what's called cryonization.
And how about your digital self?
My digital self will, I believe, be, after a span of some years, be activated as a mind clone of my flesh brain and will continue a life in cyberspace.
Now, when you say a mind clone of your flesh brain and be in cyberspace, I think you lost listeners there.
Sure.
A little bit. What is a mind clone?
Mind clone is if you take all of your digital reflections of yourself, which you've uploaded to the cloud and to servers in your computers, all of your Facebook postings, all of your likes, all of your blogs, all of your photos, all of your Instagrams, if you take all of that, and then you purchase some software called Mindware that elicits the personality evident in those uploads. And you combine the two, you end up with a mind clone of yourself, a software version of your mind that has most of your memories, feelings, recollections, and beliefs, and also has your characteristic expressions, mannerisms, and how you think.
Now, who wants to be around Martine's mind clone? Do you think your wife, your kids, who else beyond that?
No offense. Yeah, no problem. I think my friends would also want to be around my mind clone. And where, I would also want to be around their mind clone.
Where would you live? Where would the mind clone live?
The mind clone would live in the cloud and presents itself wherever there's a display.
And by the way, I'd be curious about my mind clone because, you know, I don't know myself enough to know what that mind clone would be. Are you kind of curious about what the outer manifestation of yourself is beyond what I see in front of me?
I think there'll be lots of books written about with titles such as 10 Things I Learned About Myself from My Mind Clone.
You live in Vermont, and you have started this organization called TerraSim, which mm-hmm. is devoted to life extension. And I think of Vermont as being bucolic, and here you have this, you know, uber futuristic endeavor. And it reminds me of your experience at the Seychelles, which I have not been there. Also, in my mind, seems like a, you know, placid bed of islands, yet NASA was tracking satellite systems behind a closed door.
Correct.
Do you think about that dichotomy in both places?
I do. I think that Vermont is very bucolic and beautiful. On the other hand, Vermont is also a place where there are a lot of great scientists and information technology. IBM has a major center there. University of Vermont has one of the nation's most advanced gene sequencing machines. So there's a lot more technology going on in Vermont than people would expect.
What is something that I might not know about you? We're talking about how you're trans a lot of things.
One thing you might not know about me is that I have not purchased a ticket on a rocket ship ride around the Earth, and I have no interest in doing so. My feeling is that the Earth is the greatest spaceship in the universe. We can see almost all the different stars, certainly in our own galaxy. As we travel around the sun, we get a different perspective of the entire sky. In the meanwhile, we're perfectly comfortable. We can breathe the air. We can jump and swim and fly in the air. So I treasure above everything else Spaceship Earth.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Martine Rothblatt. Coming up, we'll meet Jessamine Rodriguez, founder of Hot Bread Kitchen. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jessamine Rodriguez, the founder of Hot Bread Kitchen, an organization that teaches immigrant women to bake the artisanal breads from their home country. Hot Bread Kitchen's ethnic breads are available at farmers markets throughout New York City and at select grocery stores such as Whole Foods and Dina DeLuca. Prior to Hot Bread Kitchen, Jessamine held a range of jobs, such as working on immigration issues at the UN and helping to launch a New York City public school. She was also the first woman to be hired as a baker for Chef Daniel Boulud's 3-star Michelin restaurant, Daniel. Jessamine launched Hot Bread Kitchen from her apartment in Brooklyn. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
If I were to walk into Hot Bread Kitchen's bakery today, what would I see?
You know, it is truly a hive of activity. We're in this really quirky building underneath the Metro North tracks at 115th and Park in Manhattan. It was 10,000 square feet of public market space that we built out into a bakery and incubator. So the first thing you'll notice when you walk into Hot Bread Kitchen is just thousands of pounds of dough being processed into challahs, into emsemen, into bialys, into Persian breads, into all of these breads. Any time of day except for maybe 3:30 a.m. in the morning, there's bread on the table and women around the table making bread and baking bread.
I often am so curious when I walk into a bakery anywhere in the city and I see these beautiful tarts and croissants and cookies. And I'm wondering, who and where are they baking this? You're one example of where it's happening.
It's a great question. And you know what? I would say the question to where they're baking it, unfortunately, fewer and fewer of them are getting baked in the city. The price of real estate has left most bakeries kind of moving to New Jersey and moving out of the city. And people are having to really travel for those jobs. So one of the real innovations of what we're doing is moving into a community with high density of population and helping and a high unemployment rate and helping to create a lot of jobs in that area.
What are these women doing prior to getting trained by you?
Nancy Mendez was selling DVDs in the subways before she came to Hot Bread Kitchen. Liv Vanessa came with her husband, who's a manager at Burger King, from Bangladesh. And her story is really interesting because when she came for her interview, her husband came with her and didn't really let her speak for herself, and her English was so limited that she didn't feel confident enough to speak. And now that Vanessa's one of the managers in the kitchen.
Could you talk briefly about your post-program placement? The jobs that women get after range from, bakeries in New York City to starting their own businesses.
There's two training outcomes. The first is that women start their own food businesses. So a woman that we hired about 2 years ago is named Fanny, and she came in and learned how to bake. And once she was in the bakery training program, we realized that she had been running a catering company out of her home kitchen. So she was out of her home kitchen catering, 100-person Ecuadorian weddings. And we helped her formalize her catering business, and she graduated to become a member of our incubator kitchen. The more typical for us is seeking good management track positions in bakeries and food manufacturing facilities around the city. We have placed bakers at Whole Foods. We placed bakers at Maison Kaiser, Danielle. We placed bakers at other smaller bakeries that people might not recognize that are a little bit off the radar.
Hot Bread Kitchen is a culmination of experiences that you had, and you had the seed for this idea kind of in your back pocket for almost a decade. What are some events that influenced your starting HBK? For instance, you lived in Guatemala, where you would go every day with a mother to a corn mill.
Yeah, it's funny. So I spent some time when I was in college doing development work in Guatemala City. It was years later that I remembered this experience, but I was living with a family for a number of weeks only. But I was fascinated by the process of soaking corn and grinding corn. So the woman who I was, the mother of the house where I was living, made fresh corn tortillas that were just tremendously delicious. And we every morning we would take the soaked corn and go to a community molino, which is where they grind corn, and bring home the fresh masa, and we would make tortillas. And, at that point, I would have never thought that I would end up running a tortilla company 10 years later, but it somehow was like life experience that I cataloged for this later entrepreneurial iteration.
You also interviewed at an organization called Women World Banking, which also kind of influenced this endeavor. How so?
The real idea for Hot Bread Kitchen, the real kernel of the idea for Hot Bread Kitchen, came early on in my professional career. When I had just recently graduated from college, I interviewed for a job in New York City for Women's World Banking, which is a phenomenal microfinance institution. And I didn't get that executive assistant job, but I told someone about it, and he heard Women's World Baking. And for me, that was evocative of kind of this of an immigrant women's baking collective. And I still have notes from back then. And I, my early 20s self, I sort of started to think about what it would mean and got quickly intimidated and realized I didn't have what it would take to pull it off. Started this other career, but kind of just kept pulling experiences together. And then in 2006, learned how to bake.
It seems while you still had this thread of immigration and interest in food, you also had a strong social mission in your pursuits. You worked at a New York City public school. You helped to launch one. Did you feel like you were kind of fumbling through your 20s, or was it more of a very kind of mindful adventure that you were on, or somewhere in between?
I ended up in graduate school, and that felt very intentional. My degree is very specific. I really focused on immigration policy, and I thought that I wanted to get a job doing immigration policy. And then at the point of graduation, I was like, oh God, what does that mean? And I just was not interested or motivated to do that kind of work, which is when I made the switch into public education. So I got involved in the school startup, and I did that for 4 years.
So while you were working at the public school, you cloned yourself and also got a Master Baker certificate at the new school. When did you decide to do that?
So I did that in 2006. Somebody said to me, you know, I had been talking about this idea for Women's World Baking for a long time. And she said, well, you're not an immigrant and you're not a baker. So like, why, how, what do you have that you bring to this project? So it made me realize I would need to learn how to bake. And then the real, I think, game changer in the trajectory of Hot Bread Kitchen is that I landed this apprenticeship in the bakery at Restaurant Danielle. And my first day at work, I think it was really telling because I loved being in the bakery.
How did you land that apprenticeship, which ultimately translated into a full-time job where you were the first woman hired in the bakery?
My boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, had worked in the front of house in wine service at Danielle, and he introduced me to Mark Fiorentino, who is a benevolent, wonderful human being who took pity on my weak baking skills and took me in under his wing and taught me at that point everything I knew about baking.
And at what point during that job were you feeling, I'd like to go ahead and start this Hot Bread Kitchen?
I only learned how to bake to start Hot Bread Kitchen.
You seem very self-directed and self-starting. What were you like as a child? I know it's open-ended, but yeah. Do you think that way about yourself?
I don't think I have ever responded well to a lot of authority. I think that that's been a thread through my life, and now I have a 3-year-old, and she's exactly the same way.
And now you wish you responded better to authority.
Yeah, exactly.
You're from Canada.
I'm from Canada.
What did your parents do?
My parents were both educators. So my father was a teacher. My mother is a professor. I think at home, I knew that I had to follow rules, and they were supportive of creativity. And I think understood that I had a certain independent spirit. I started traveling relatively young. And then in college, I spent time traveling alone through South America, just kind of exploring because I didn't find that university was necessarily worthwhile.
Your grandmother played an important role in what you're doing now, kind of indirectly. How so?
Yeah. I attribute a lot of the personality piece to my paternal grandmother, who factors very strongly in my life. You know, she lived close by when I was growing up.
In Toronto.
And she was widowed in her 30s and then became an insurance broker in the 50s. Was just very clear about what she wanted for her granddaughter. And I was the only granddaughter. And so she put, you know, I think I took those signals and translated into a certain kind of independence.
What does she make of this?
When I launched Hot Bread Kitchen, all she could say was, what? You have a graduate degree from Columbia and you're going to open a bakery? It was like completely unfathomable to her. And then in 2009, we got a feature in Food and Wine magazine, which was like this glorious, you know, piece about what we do. And that was the first moment where she acknowledged that, okay, maybe this is a good idea.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jessamine Rodriguez, the founder of Hot Bread Kitchen, a New York City-based organization that focuses on utilizing the bread-making skills that immigrant women have brought with them from their country of origin. Hot Bread Kitchen's ethnic breads are available at some of the city's leading restaurants, including Danny Meyer's Gramercy Tavern and the restaurant at the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. The women in the Hot Bread Kitchen program learn management, English, and other skills that they can carry with them to jobs at larger bakeries or entrepreneurial baking ventures of their own. So you decide to leave Danielle, and Mark knew your intention from the inception.
I think that's why Mark took me into the program, is because he knew how hard it was to find good bakers. And he was really motivated to train me so that he could get this pipeline of well-trained bakers. It was, he's benevolent, but it was a little self-serving.
And you started Hot Bread Kitchen out of your Brooklyn apartment.
I did. Much to my roommate's chagrin at that point.
What did your apartment smell like?
It smelled like good bread. It smelled like tortillas and bread, but also wet tents, because I was selling in farmers markets at that point. So I remember storing my tents in the living room, and the roommates were really accommodating.
And at what point did this become more institutional?
I moved it out of the house pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Initially, I baked actually a few shifts from Bread for Sale out of the bakery at Danielle. Mm-hmm. But then we moved into a shared commercial kitchen in Queens. And, you know, early on, they were the slog years. I baked overnight and then would sell all day in farmers markets and do my own delivery to wholesale accounts. It's like a typical small bootstrap startup story. The game changer came with some of the early philanthropic supporters that came on that gave us the initial boost that we needed to continue.
Simultaneous with baking 24/7, were you grant writing or did you have random introductions to people?
No, I was grant writing. My mom helped me write some of the early grants. Mm. For a while, I still kept consulting on the side to kind of pay the rent. And then in 2008, I got a competitive fellowship for social entrepreneurs, which allowed me to quit my day job. Mm. But yes, I mean, the hard part about it is that I was doing the kind of intellectual work. I was doing the business planning. I was doing the grant writing. I was doing all of those things while also like baking bread and grinding corn and, mm-hmm. you know, hiring and managing people.
Who were one or two or seven of the initial women?
The first woman that we hired was Elidia Ramos. And Elidia spent countless hours working with me on the overnight shift. And Elidia loved to give advice. And so we had so many hours to talk. At that point, I was single and dating and like looking for love. And she was married and had three kids. We were about the same age, but we were kind of, you know, she was vicariously living through my maturation. And the best line from Elidia, there was this guy that she knew that worked at Danielle, because I had gotten her husband a job in the kitchen at Danielle. There was a butcher at Danielle that Elidia knew through mm-hmm. her husband. He got divorced from his wife, so he was single. And so Elidia really, really thought that I should
Meet the butcher.
And I just remember her saying, pero Jessa sabe cortar carne. Like, he's a great guy. He knows how to cut meat. Like, what else could you want in a husband? And those were the kind of Elidia gems that still stick with me to this day. And her kind of work ethic and her ethos and many of her ideas have permeated the company.
Now, you mentioned you were single, yet it was your boyfriend, Ellie, now your husband at the time, who introduced you to Danielle. So did you take a hiatus from each other?
We did. We had a little bit of a hiatus. And, you know, it was those early years where I wasn't single, but there was, you know, it took a while for us to get more serious.
And Ellie works in the wine department at Sotheby's.
Yes.
You also got an Eileen Fisher grant early mm-hmm. on.
They were, I think, our first funder that wasn't a friend writing a check.
And Eileen Fisher is the clothing designer.
Yeah, the mm-hmm. clothing designer. And she has a grant for female social entrepreneurs. And so the grant forced me, to write the business plan. It brought me into this wonderful network of, you know, it's such a women-dominated company and they're so progressive and it's a real model of, I think, how business should be run. Mm-hmm. And then also got a lot of New York City-based customers through them. And then it's a real recognizable name. So once Elaine Fisher came on board, it was kind of like the stamp of approval that I needed from other potential funders in the social enterprise space.
What has surprised you about, you know, this?
Oh, what surprises me is that the feeling of knowing that you're feeding so many New Yorkers every day. Last night when I was leaving the bakery, there was probably about 3,000 or 4,000 pieces of bread waiting to be packed.
And we're picky folk.
Exactly. There's this kind of just like sense of awe, like, wow, I get to feed all these people. I get to be at so many people's brunch. And then, you know, some Monday mornings I'll open up my email and somebody I haven't heard from in, you know, 4 or 5 years will email and be like, I buy your product at the market every day, but I noticed that there was this new olive loaf and I'm so excited. And I took it home and I made a whitefish salad and it was delicious. I made a whitefish sandwich and it was delicious. And thank you.
You are kind of the connective tissue for a lot of strange bedfellows in New York because your mission is to educate through commerce these immigrant women who are marginalized with people at farmers markets who can afford fancy bread.
Yeah, that's I think a good way to articulate it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think our core competency is opening up this really growing, immense specialty food market to people who otherwise wouldn't access it. We're helping the woman who's selling tamales in her community at 116th and Lexington get that product into Whole Foods.
You have two children. How present are they in what's going on?
They're omnipresent. My kids spend a lot of time at the bakery. They've got 35 aunties who look out for them at all times. But like every working mom, I struggle to keep all the pieces together. And my daughter eats a lot of bread. And I used to say when she was tiny that eating so much bread was her trying to get more of me back to her. That was somehow a metaphor for her need for more of my time. So it's hard being an entrepreneur, especially in the early years of entrepreneurship and yeah. balanced parenting. But I'm the mother that I want my kids to know. Maybe I'm not the mother I want them to know when they're one, but I'm the mother I want them to know when they're 10 and 15 and 20.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jessamine Rodriguez, founder of Hot Bread Kitchen. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.